the Tarncast, Tarncast. The Tarncast, Tarncast. It's the Tarncast, Tarncast. The Tarncast, Tarncast. The Tarncast, Tarncast. It's the Tarncast, Tarncast. This is the Tarncast, Tarncast. The Tarncast, the Tarncast.
Hello and welcome to the Tarncast. I'm your guest host today, Kenneth Cosby, and I'm here sitting across from a Tarncast regular, Mr. Todd Anderson.
Hey, thanks for having me back on the Tarncast. I really appreciate it.
Not a problem.
This is the first time I've done a podcast, I guess this is a live podcast in a theater. It's too bad nobody showed up.
Well, these seats are kind of squeaky. And I think there's, like, all theaters has a ghost, but I think this ghost, being in North Hollywood, probably has a meth habit. It's just... this is a cool little place, but I was glad that I was able to interview you and talk to you today, because it's been a long time since we've seen each other.
Yeah, it has been a long time.
It's been a long time since I've seen you.
Well, I see you on the social medias and stuff.
Yes, it was. It's kind of like, I think it was the other day I was watching, I forget which commercial it was, and I was sitting next to my girlfriend. This was Todd, and then right after that, there was a advertisement for You're the Worst. So it was just kind of like boom, boom, boom. Oh, it was just kind of like, that's a lot of Todd in like, you know, like but a minute and 20, but it's
it
cool.
It comes in very brief intervals. It's not like you have to sit with me for 2 hours.
Oh, no, but I mean, I enjoyed that anyhow, you know, when we were younger, but I also was a lot, I drank more.
I think I'm more enjoyable if you drink more. I think in general.
I mean, I think we all were back then. But, yeah. You know, you've always been one of those guys I liked anyhow. So it's not I didn't need to drink to be around you, but it was fun. And now that I'm older and I really can't, because it's just old age does that to you.
It makes drinking hard?
Well, it makes recovery hard.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, your hangovers last 3 days instead of a morning.
Because I did a stand-up show the other day and people were just buying me shots. And then I woke up the next morning and had to be someplace at night and I didn't feel... well, until like 3 days later, I was groggy.
Were you mixing the shots, or were you consistent?
I was consistent, but the thing about it is, I normally do my Guinness Jameson, and then I went through Guinness Jameson.
Oh,
and then like I decided I'm going to go home, drink water, and eat bread, and my body was like, "Dude, you got diabetes that runs in your family. You sat up there, shot all that sugar down your body.
Right?
What you're going to need to do is some exercise. How about that?" Sweat this out of your body.
Does exercise help you with the hangovers?
It used to. I mean, if I do like a brisk when I could jog.
can't jog now? Did you?
I tore my patella tendon twice within 7 months.
Oh, shit.
So basically like it was atrophy on top of atrophy.
Yeah.
So it was one of those things. It took about a year and a half for me to get all my leg muscles back.
Yeah.
So jogging always gets to a point where like, this is fun, but if I steps off the sidewalk weird, I'm like, I ain't doing this again.
Yeah, I literally just started lifting very light weights after a year of not lifting weights because I got tendonitis. Mm. Tennis elbow without playing tennis. I put it together that, you know, I was rock and rolling the dumbbells too fast and I jacked up my elbow.
Yeah, the thing for me is I was playing basketball with my girlfriend and we had a kind of slightly deflated ball. So I let her get like about 8 points ahead of me. We were playing horse. I said, fuck, I'm just going to lay it down on her. And I went to like go like to do this 3-pointer and I stepped on a leaf. But underneath the leaf was a piece of styrofoam cup. So it was outside in the park. So I planted my left leg to stop myself from hitting the concrete when I slipped. Oh. I planted it too hard.
Well, at least you didn't concuss yourself.
Oh, I did on top of that.
Oh, you got a concussion?
My patella tendon snapped. So all of my weight went flying back.
So you still landed on your head?
I still landed on my head.
Jesus.
So then my legs up there like wiggling like a noodle. And then 3 days before my last physical therapy appointment, I'm coming back from a job interview to tutor kids. And she was demanding that I get my live scan right then. I said, I'll wait. And we're in downtown L.A. This woman T-bones her car. My knee hits the dashboard. And an hour later, it swelled up like a grapefruit and had to do it again.
Oh, my God.
So it was like calling my... physical therapist going like, yeah, I can't be there today because I've got to go see my orthopedic surgeon across the street and have them do, because they said if it happens again, I'd have to get a tendon from a cadaver. So,
oh my God,
I don't want any dead people's parts in me.
Why not?
Well, because I think I'll get a white dude's patella tendon, and you know, I just don't. I mean, I can still run somewhat, you know, but I don't want, like, if the cops are chasing me, my dude, hey, he's okay.
You don't need to
run. I don't need to do that, so.
You don't need to run, you dummy. Oh, that's hilarious.
It made me stop wearing hoodies. That I just couldn't do it.
You stopped wearing hoodies?
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't put them over my head.
Right.
Yeah, and I just started going like, hmm.
Yeah, I guess that's my white privilege is I'll fucking put a hood on if it's cold. I don't care. But yeah, that sucks.
Yeah.
You can't wear hoodies. Hoodies are so easy. They're awesome. You throw them on and they keep you warm.
I've got some nice stylish ones where I used to wear like with a suit shirt underneath it and a tie, and it was kind of like this whole like Russell Simmons look.
Yeah.
And then I just got to a point where, you know, I'm walking and realizing that, you know, I've got this hoodie on. I'm in this like neighborhood that's kind of iffy, da 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 da. And it's like I can't pull out my resume of education if a cop pulls me over. So I basically said, if I just kind of like have it in my arm and I'm looking like I'm a student or something, like I'm studious, I might be okay.
That's way too complicated to deal with a fucking hoodie. That's ridiculous.
Yeah, so I just basically, they're like there and I wear them like if I go to the gym or if I'm working. Like if the sun is out, I wear them.
Sure.
If it's dark, I think about it.
Jesus Christ. No, I'm mad. I'm mad. That sucks.
Yeah.
So, well, then, as long as we're discussing this, how are you with the state of our nation currently?
Well,
I mean, I guess it's the state of our nation, and it has been the state of our nation.
It has been the state of our nation forever, but there are two things that pop into my head. With people that love football, and I slowly stopped watching football after Junior Seau committed suicide.
Mm-hmm.
Because when I was teaching at USC, Junior would show up at class, you know, not my class, but he'd be on campus. You'd talk to him and hang out. He was one of my favorite players, and I started teaching at USC in 96, so he was already a pro. But he would come back to campus and just be this really great, nice guy. So when that happened, I started thinking about what am I witnessing every time I watched the game, and then the game started to get even worse. It just started to suck more, and last year, I barely watched any games. Except I had to watch the Super Bowl because I'm from Atlanta.
Right.
And the Patriots basically said they played the role of Sherman in that at the end. They just destroyed Atlanta. And
yeah, that was rough. And I'm from New England, and I was making fun of all the before the game ended because it looked like such a blowout.
Yeah.
And then I was like, oh, shit. Like, I turned it off.
And
then like later was like, oh, shit. I'm going to get so much crap for that dig that I put up on social media.
I literally went to the kitchen to get some pizza, and I turned around and I heard this roar, but it was a different roar. And all of a sudden, I started my phone text from my friends from Georgia, like, "What the fuck's going on?" I'm like, "Okay,
wow."
I mean, I get a lot more writing done than I'm not watching it, but I think the idea is the way that this country's been going. The element of race has never really been dealt with.
No,
and even if you pass laws, it's not like you're doing anything but basically trying to regulate people's, you know, their behavior.
I don't know. I don't think that passing laws is a good idea. But I do think that perhaps if this country, I mean, it's people of color in general. There's Native Americans and there's black people, and this country has never made reparations for the crimes against humanity. Like, Germany fucking did it.
Yeah.
But our shit was older than that.
Yeah.
You know? In a lot of ways, the shit that we did in this country emboldened the Nazi movement.
Right. And the thing about it is that growing up in the South and seeing it every day.
Sure.
It wasn't like there was a point in time where I escaped it in any shape, size, or form.
Right.
So it got to a point where, and this is the scary thing, that you get used to it. And it also hurts all the time.
Right.
So when you get to a point like now where you're seeing so much visibility, that the idea of talking to somebody and explaining, like, this is what it's really about.
Right.
You know, and if you're not understanding that, you're completely missing the issue. It's just like, if Trump really cared about the flag, then enforce the flag code.
Yeah.
Enforce it.
Yeah, and why are you letting Kid Rock run around in the White House when he uses American flags as fucking ponchos?
Right, and then people that are wearing, you know, the bikinis and everything, then half of the flags that he's wearing, you know, pretty much are made in China. It's just like, you know, all this stuff that you're not supposed to do, people do and call it, you know, I'm being an American.
Right, right.
And for me, it's just like, you know, having family members that have constantly served in the military,
uh-huh.
having people that I know closely that have fought hard. The whole transgender ban makes no sense to me because nobody's worried about that if they're going actually into battle.
Right.
To deal with
well, and that, also it was a fucking non-issue until he made it an issue. He made it an issue. Like, so much of these issues, I think, the NFL thing, I think there's also revenge on his part,
mm-hmm.
you know, because he had his problems with the NFL in the past as a quote-unquote businessman. So much of that, it just seems like he's fucking rabble-rousing and trying to create all these insane things surrounding him.
Well, to distract from the failure that he's going through.
Yeah.
I mean, if you think about New York City that voted 91% for Hillary, these are the people that know him the best.
Right.
And you're dealing with a man that has never apologized for anything that he's done.
No.
He's still dealing with the Central Park Five, wanting them all to be, you know, destroyed, even though DNA proved that they didn't commit the crime. When he got called out as a racist when he had The Apprentice, he made sure that Arsenio Hall won the next time. It was just like, you know, everything's structurally laid down for his benefit. And now it gets to a point where I watch a lot of investigation, you know, the IDTV with all the murder mysteries because it's common to my I could rather watch that than
you CNN. Like crime documentaries and all that?
Well, I watch it because it's just easier to deal with than Trump. It's just easier. You know, some man gets angry and hacks his wife to death, and then she's not dead, then testifies against him. And then you go, like, he's talking about fake news. And I'll turn on a little bit, and then I realize that my soul is starting to feel like...
It's hard to watch. I can't even... Like, I tried to watch Jimmy Kimmel, because everybody's been, Jimmy Kimmel, he's the only, you know, rich guy, white talk show host in the night who's not... been a complete asshole in the last few weeks and done something dumb.
Right.
So I watched it. And I couldn't enjoy it because so much of it was Trump.
Yeah.
And so much of it was footage of Trump manipulated. And here's Trump saying this and here's Trump saying that. Mm-hmm. And then none of the jokes were landing for me because I was like, I just had to watch Trump for 45 seconds.
Right.
In order to set up this bit that he's doing.
Right.
And it just is like, I don't know, it's hard to find it funny.
Yeah, well, yes, because there's a point in time where you're basically, on one level, preaching to the choir. And then on another level, it's kind of like that humanity that we're trying to connect with gets lost. Like, the thing that popped into my head when I was watching a little bit of the Russian investigation and found out that he had, you know, fake accounts for the pseudo Black Lives Matter group.
Mm-hmm.
It actually had more followers than the Black Lives Matter group.
Right.
The Russians had created create this racial divide. And for me, something in my head was just kind of like, from a societal point of view, my brain is trying to, like, deconstruct that.
Right.
And realizing that, you know, this country as a whole, I mean, it's like, it's the promise of what we could be.
Right.
And how kind of we've failed that education-wise, which started probably in the... I'm going to blame it specifically on the Reagan years. When they started pulling away, you know, certain levels of education and turning everything to standardized where kids now regurgitate information and they don't retain facts. Well,
that's absolutely... I agree. I mean, that's absolutely on the shoulders of the Republican Party. Mm-hmm. And when you think about, you know, the... I don't like the slogan, obviously, Make America Great Again.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not because Trump decided to use it.
Yeah.
I just think it's dumb.
Well, he lifted it from Reagan.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's dumb anyway because when are we talking about?
Yeah.
When do you think it was great? But when we were having an economic, you know, upturn and we were actually the richest place in the world and there was lots of money and people were moving, you know, there was upward mobility and all that stuff. So much of that was because of free fucking education.
Mm-hmm.
Free education.
Yeah.
And they stripped it, you know, and now they've got all these new reasons why the economy isn't as good and the country's fucked up.
Right.
And it's because we don't educate people the way we used to.
We educate them to be workers rather than to be innovators. And the ones that can be innovators are in areas where they're not really socially diverse. So you're dealing with people that have the ability to create things. And on top of that, we want to basically make sure that the best from other countries that want to come here and help us have a difficult time doing it.
Right.
We think about what our nuclear program would be if we didn't let some of those Nazi doctors slip into the country on the benefit of like, just saying like, well, you know, we forget the Nuremberg trials. Come help us, you know, beat these Koreans.
Right.
And that's exactly
what we're doing. Yeah, help us build rockets, you
rockets,
guys.
And then
we'll let you off the hook.
Bomb the crap out of North Korea. And then next, why is Kim Jong-un upset with us now? Gee.
I don't know.
This is,
well, I
have you heard about the 38th parallel? What? What?
Mm-hmm.
That's my favorite basketball number. Shut up.
Well, I mean, you know, that's the old cliche, is those who don't understand their history are doomed to repeat it.
Yeah.
But I also think there's an element of people just, it's not that they don't understand it. It's that they don't know it.
Yeah, and they don't care.
And they don't care.
I mean, you ask the average person, not the, well, pretty much the average person, what year did 9/11 happen?
Right. I don't know.
9/11, man. Why are you asking me? Don't disrespect me by asking me to remember something other than the date.
Right.
And just without the year.
Yeah. Well, when did that? Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, we're in our that was our generation's Kennedy assassination.
Yeah.
So we won't forget it.
No.
But I think most people either born after it who were or were so young they weren't registering really what's going on. Don't it I, just in general. I mean, certainly the just less than half of the registered voters who voted in the last election don't give a shit what year it happened anyway. It's just a tool. As when that happened, the thing that other than the actual event that enraged me was watching George Bush address Congress about his plans to start a war.
Mm-hmm.
And they applauded every fucking thing he said. Because, of course, like everybody comes together when there's like a attack. And
then
it creates a sort of common enemy. But that's exactly what they wanted.
Yeah.
All that talk about if we don't keep doing this, if we don't keep doing this, the terrorists win. They won.
Yeah.
They won, and it has reverberated since, and it is constantly used as a tool for bullshit.
Right, and because even now that we're dealing with what we've been there 16 years and still dealing with the fact that now, because we can't secure any type of definite plan of victory, now it's starting to seep back into our own society.
Right.
Because I know right shortly after that, all of my Indian friends and all of my Arabic friends were so nervous.
Hebrew,
and just, you know, spending time with people, you know, and hanging out, having people walk up saying shit, you know. And that was a difficult time from just, you know, people going, hey, Ken, I got to do this show. Can you walk me out to my car after the show?
Yeah.
You know, and it's just... like when people say, well, you know, this is not the America that we live in. I'm like, yes, it is. It always has been. And
right.
To ignore that is like forgetting this whole history of what the hell we've been doing this whole time. I mean, the Voters' Rights Act is still an act. It's not a law.
Right.
And that's what I get worried, like, you know, if Trump pisses off black people enough, is he just going to, like, pull it away?
Right.
Now we can't. But, well, it was an act, and Obama should have, like, made it a law, and he didn't. So we didn't care about you, so it's Obama's fault. And then we'll yank it.
Right.
I doubt he'll do that. Okay, I won't say that because as soon as I say that, he probably will. But that's an actual thought that crosses my mind, you know, all the time. It's like I vote crazy,
right,
you know, and research it. But the idea that it can be taken away because of all the presidents we've had, nobody said, let's make this a law.
Yeah.
Does not make me feel really comfortable as a citizen of this country.
No. I don't know. Well, obviously... discomfort is sort of the black experience in this country, and it has been for a long time. I'm the thing about this, and I've always been aware of it. I mean, I grew up in Massachusetts. We're in the 80s. It's a very segregated state.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there were very distinct black neighborhoods.
Right.
My white-ass town, you know, we had the Medco students who would come in, and those were the black people.
Yeah.
They didn't live in the town.
Right.
And the one black family that moved to our town stayed for 2 years before they moved out. And this guy, he was a, I think he was a doctor, and he lived next to one of my buddies. And so him, my buddy's dad and him would go golfing. And in the 2 years he was there, there was one family that would have a neighborhood, like, 4th of July party or whatever it was. And they would invite fucking literally everybody on the street except this one family that lived directly across from them. And so he finally said to my friend's dad, he said, you want to know why I'm leaving? It's just, we're not welcome.
Yeah.
I don't need this shit.
Yeah.
I'm rich.
Yeah.
I don't need this shit. Right. I can go somewhere else where people will be like, hey, welcome to the neighborhood. Yeah. This is bullshit. And whether it was, you know, subconscious on the part of the family that lived across the street or if it was aggressive racism, who knows?
Right.
You know, but the racism was there.
Yeah. Well, it's like I grew up in Atlanta, but I went to a private school. So for 14 years, I lived in Atlanta proper where the whole neighborhood was black. Then at 14, we moved to Fayetteville, Georgia. We were the first black family to move into the subdivision.
Mm-hmm.
But luckily for me, I wrestled in middle school and everything. So my biggest wrestling rival lived like literally five houses down from me.
Uh-huh.
So the second day, I've got Craig Dow pulling up in front of my house with "Hey, Ken! Hey, Ken, heard you're moving to Fayetteville." And then everybody kind of knew me from acting and wrestling, so it was a little bit more, "That's Ken Cosman, man.
Right,
you know,
right.
He's a guy I've been beating for the past 8 years. That's Ken." And hanging out with these people. So it was a little bit like a, more of a merge, but the school that we went to was very, very exclusive, and we didn't have as much diversity as they do now.
Yeah.
But the amount of diversity that we did have was kind of incredible. I mean, having students that like were Cuban, Dominican, Indian, Asian, from Taiwan, especially if you did band and were in theater.
Right.
On top of like doing sports. I mean, the basic thing for me, it was like I was the only black guy on the wrestling team. And of course, I did sprints. Kind of like, we're five black guys that can run fast. Okay. Track meets were always great because we're going up against these like schools where it's just like they've got two black guys and two white guys and two black guys are running the anchor legs. So basically, start track meets. It's like, this guy's like got 90 yards on this last leg. Should I even try? You try and catch him. I'll just grab the baton. There were points in time like, I'm going to miss the baton just so I don't have to be this embarrassed at this point in time. It's just like, I don't want to do it. But again, as we come together as a country, it's kind of like dealing with the fallacies of not being able to look at ourselves and just as human beings as a whole, and look at our faults and figure out taking responsibility of what they are and what can we do to repair them. That type of work, even as an individual, is a difficult thing to do. And that's why it's been so weird where it's so blatantly out there in trying to deal with people that call themselves Christians, but, you know, don't know the words of Christ and say stupid crap and trying to figure
I'm having been brought up Catholic and lapsed the fuck out of it, I'm not... I'm not a fan of Christianity on any level. I'm not a fan of religion either. I mean, you talk about Islam and the prejudice towards Muslims. I'm not a fan of Islam, the religion. The way that's embedded in a lot of the governments and the countries in the middle. Women can't fucking drive.
Yeah.
I mean, that's bananas.
But it's a loose construction. I mean, that's the same thing. Like when I talk to Christians and ask them, you know, how many of you read the Bible versus people telling you what it is.
Right.
And if you've got a problem with Islam, then how many of you have read the Quran?
Right. And have a problem with
it. You know, if you don't like Jews, how have you read the, you know, the Torah?
Right.
And then what? It's like, well, see, now you're dealing with this TV idea of what it is, but you don't know the constructs and what's broken down.
Right. Well, every time I read a religious text, and I've not read the Quran. I admit to that, but I read the Torah because it was the Old Testament, and I read the New Testament growing up, obviously. And I did read Dianetics, and what all of the – and I read some Buddhist texts, and the Quran was the only one I didn't read because it was like, I don't feel like I need to read another religious text because the one thing that you have uniformly is they don't make any fucking sense. You know? I mean, when people – people, when I first moved to LA, you know, people were making fun of Dianetics and, mm-hmm. and Scientology, but they were kind of scared of it,
yeah.
you know, because the church does weird stuff.
Yeah.
But it's still a church, and I'm reading Dianetics, and I'm like, this is a religious text full of science fiction mm-hmm. in the same way that the Old Testament and the New Testament are filled with supernatural bullshit.
Right.
It's just a genre choice.
Right.
But when you look at either one, maybe there's lessons to be had. Maybe there's some positivity to be had. But mm-hmm. ultimately, the thing is a massive construct, is bizarre and makes no sense.
Yes, but the thing that's great, I mean, I've had people that were Scientologists that had drug problems and alcohol problems, and it helped them.
Sure. Well, the same thing with Christianity.
Yeah.
I mean, Alcoholics Anonymous has a lot of God in it.
Right. But I will tell you this, just as a performer, if you've ever done one of those Scientology industrials,
no.
those checks come early and they clear. I did three of them, and I never had a problem with the Church and Scientology's checks clearing. They would get there early, and I'm like, what the hell is this? I'm like, I do these all the time, and I was completely fine, and they would leave me alone. Until the last shoot I did. And some young kid, I guess he didn't get the memo to just leave me alone.
Uh-huh.
So he kept trying to push doing the personality test.
Oh.
And I was going like, you know, you look like the type of kid who'd be on shorts in a boat out in the international. Well, you know, the boat that L. Ron Hubbard.
The Sea Org.
Yes. You know, would you like to put on some shorts and just bring him back up from the dead and just hang out with him on a boat?
And clean a deck with a toothbrush?
And all the people were like, oh, Lord, dude, they just pulled the kid away. And I was like, oh, man,
What were you doing in these industrials? Were you just...
Play either like a security guard. I mean, I was like, having, right. you know, like dialogue and stuff. And, you know, just people were in trouble. And I would sit back there and explain to them about, you know, how drugs do a certain thing, you know, and you shouldn't do drugs. It was always, you know...
Right.
Mr. Black Security Guard is going to come up here and explain with drugs. And I would say that, and I'd be there for like maybe 3 hours. And they always paid like a little bit above scale. So you felt like, oh,
yeah,
my day rate's gone up for Scientology. And again, you know, while I'm there, it's completely. But then I've seen the flip side of that. And like, it was a religious studies minor at NYU. So I had to read most of the text. And it was funny. I was coming back from something, and I was at LAX. And this guy, he was a Hare Krishna, and he had a Bhagavad Gita. And we were like talking about just the constructs of the Bhagavad Gita, and he's looking at me going like, I'm not even going to ask you for money here. You can have a free copy of the book. So I've got this like huge ass Bhagavad Gita.
Wow.
It was like free. It was like, you know, because he was trying to get money from, we had this, I've never talked to a person like you. I know what like you meant. I knew this much about the Bhagavad Gita, and he just gave it to me. And I was like, this is great. But, you know, it's... We as human beings can be better.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think we have a lot more time to be better.
if we don't get – well, that's the thing. I mean it does feel like we're standing on the precipice. And, you know, we as human beings can be hysterical too en masse.
Yeah.
But the thing I don't understand about climate change deniers
mm-hmm.
is this. Even if you think it's bullshit,
right?
You know, the world's not getting hotter, the ocean levels aren't rising, even though every scientist on the planet is telling you, no, that's actually happening. Mm-hmm. But the argument to clean up the environment, like why?
Yeah.
Why is that negative? Like even if you think it's fucking bullshit, like if it was a religious thing,
right?
I'd be like, oh, you. You want to reduce pollution and, you know, make things cleaner?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, sure. Let's do that.
Yeah, because that way we don't have to resurrect these jobs that already died.
Right.
I mean, that's what I've never understood. Because, like, right now, and this is not to freak anybody out as far as it lives in California, but we are we're way past the time we should have another major earthquake.
Yeah.
And we are... As far as the big ones that happen every like 400 years, we're about 50 years past when that one happens. So I was watching this where people are like, well, in California, you know, they usually have like, you know, a 9.2 like every like, you know, 300 years. And
yeah.
we're overdue for that. And then we're overdue for the big one because the last one was Northridge. Before that was Selmar in 71. And so in my apartment building, they've been like having signs for like, you know, earthquake preparedness and everything.
Sure.
And, like filling it out. And there's a point in time where just like you could... When the earth moves, you really can't do shit. It's just moving.
Right, and there's no real warning system.
Yeah.
It's not like a hurricane and staying in Key West, Florida, where everybody's telling you to get out.
Even the most advanced systems would only probably give you maybe a 30-minute notice.
Right.
And that's not enough time to do anything.
No.
I mean, I've been in line in Starbucks longer than that. So it's just like, what can we do at this point? And I still don't understand, like, these people that want you to be fruitful and multiply want to make sure that the earth is so fucked up that your kids are going to be dealing with crazy stuff. It's like, you know, when you were younger, do you remember food allergies?
No.
Neither do I. I mean, I didn't know kids were allergic to peanuts and wheat and...
Well, I think all that stuff is, you know, and I think it's so much of it has probably got to do with the manipulation of food.
Yeah.
And also just in general, the environment turning on this problem the environment has, which is us.
Right. And it seems like, you know, they're constantly trying to get rid of us, or make less of us, and we're constantly going, like, screw you.
And figuring a way around it.
Or making people that are so drugged that they don't notice. Because I remember, like, there was a kid, I don't remember food allergies. You go to somebody's house and, you know, you just like...
I mean, I know they were there, but it was...
But it wasn't like...
It was very minimal. Yeah, it was like a rare thing.
Like if a kid got stung by a bee and he went to anaphylactic shock, you know, you could understand that. Or, you can't go whatever. Sciencely, my brain is freaked out right now. But let's just say a kid gets stung by a bee and then, you know, he dies. And that was something that was common. But
yeah.
I didn't know too many kids that, like, they ate a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. So, like, as I'm sitting back there and looking at this, and especially now dealing with younger kids... You always get to a point in time, like, when the parent gives you the EpiPen.
Mm-hmm.
Like, well, your kid's going to be with you for, like, 3 or 4 hours. So just in case, and I'm like, I've got the training to do that. I'm just hoping, like, just everybody stay away. And then this one kid was chasing this other kid with his peanut butter and jelly sandwich. And I was like, of course, I couldn't discipline. It was just weird. But I just don't remember.
And you don't want to have to jam a needle into
not to the kid. And this is, like, at the same point in time, it's like, he's going to be panicking, so I'm going to be responsible. So I've got to make sure. So... I have to read the EpiPen to know exactly where I need to inject it before, so just in case it happens.
Right.
Then it doesn't happen, but that whole week, you know, as soon as that kid disappeared, where'd you go?
Right.
Where are you?
Right.
Are you playing on the playground? Don't pick up any fucking dirt. You don't know if somebody dropped some peanuts in the dirt. You're going like, oh, this would be great to bring for lunch, but, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's like the universe is going, there's way too many of you. I want to be kind of happy. It's kind of like we're the ticks on the balls of, like, the universe. And we constantly mutate so we can't be destroyed. And now it's at a point in time where it's like, just want to be happy. Just for a little bit.
Sure.
Like, people that have kids that are growing up and watching them. And I'm seeing my niece and my nephews and then friends of mine that are, you know, having kids and watching them grow up. And it's hard for me not to go to feel some type of pain. Mm. About what's been left for them. I mean, the mess keeps getting bigger and bigger, and we're not really teaching them how to deal with it because, I mean, the recent things about people going like, well, you know, these hurricanes happen because Christ is trying to...
And black football players are taking a knee during the national anthem because they hate the United States of America.
Yeah.
It's not... That's how the narrative shifts every time Trump starts yammering.
And that's what I'm saying. If you want to keep the national anthem, then just do the third verse, the one that has all the racist shit in it, and then just say that this is where America is, or change it to the national black anthem, lift every voice and sing, which would be great. I would love to see – this is an ultimate bucket list thing for me. I would love to see a white choir sing, lift every voice and sing. Because it's always a point in time, because I went to Howard for 2 years, and growing up in Atlanta, so we knew that song in and out, and it's just one of those things that you're sitting up there at an event, and they start singing, and then you see the one white dude, you know, that's had all the black friends, go, lift every voice and sing till earth and heaven, and you're like, all right, brother, all right, bring it on. But for me, it's just like, you know, people go like, well, this is all we know. Well, just put in the third verse, because that's more American
than the first one.
And then I want you to stand up
and sing it.
And sing it, but most people after the end just like,
And that's, you know, I get, and I don't know what to do. I'm just a scrapper actor in Los Angeles. You know, I mean, I sign my petitions and I make my phone calls and I do that shit.
Yeah.
Repairing race relations, I don't fucking know how to do that.
No, but it's about the small steps.
Well, small steps are wildly frustrating.
Yeah.
Because, you know, my social media feeds are full of white people.
Yeah.
Tons of white people. Right. And some of them are fucking angry as fuck about this national anthem football thing.
Right. And then you think about it, you can't, there's not a way that you can break that through because this is an emotional argument for them.
Right. And you can't, and this was true during the whole election process last year, arguing with Trump supporters. Because my wife thinks I'm nuts. Mm. Because she just fucking blocks people. It's a fucking idiot. Fucking idiot. Fucking idiot. You know, no, I've known her since childhood. I never want to see her again. Uh-huh. You know, my hairdresser's a fucking idiot. I'm finding a new hair. That's what she does.
Yeah.
Me, I'm like, well, wait a sec. Let's talk about this.
Right.
Let me explain. I'm not trying to tell you why you're wrong. I'm just going to give you the opposing argument so maybe you'll think about it.
Right.
But they don't. Right. Because they can't hear the opposing argument.
Well, this is what happened with me. I had a friend of mine that I went to high school with who I forgot – who said something about it was when Ben Carson said that slaves were immigrants. And then he basically so he goes on
I remember
my,
that, yeah.
He goes on my page and then posts this thing where Obama was talking about slavery and saying they're the two same thing. And I said, why are you comparing and contrasting two black people on my page? So then we started going back and forth and I called him a racist fuck. And then he's like, don't do that because, you know, my parents read my feed. It's like, don't come on my page with your bullshit. I said, you need to be careful because all my gay and bisexual friends are about to let you have it. 5 seconds later.
Oh, yeah.
They let him have it. Like, my trans friends, my bisexual friends, my gay friends, my Indian friends, like, everybody that was of another ethnicity started flooding his page with shit.
Right.
I was happy because they supported me. And number two, I didn't realize I had that many fans. World. I was like, oh, they came to bat for me. Shit, because I was able to, like, I don't get into these Facebook wars because I've got shit to do.
Right.
But watching what they did for me at that moment was kind of like, and then people were like secretly sending me messages. Now I know how to fight racism, and thank you again for inspiring me.
I wish people helped me with this shit. I never get any, very rarely do I get backups. I feel like a lot of people just stay quiet because they don't want to get in the argument. I, there's this guy on Facebook, you know, who I used to know from. He lived in L.A. for a while, but then he, you know, gave up, moved back to his southern hometown. You know, and he's been posting a lot of that stuff about the national anthem and these football players need to respect and just play the game and keep the politics out of the sport. And I'm like, one, politics are in everything.
Yeah.
And they always have been. And you're crazy if you think they're not. Yeah. But also, you're a racist.
Yeah.
You know, I just said, this is, you're making a racist statement. No, I'm not. You know, we go back and forth and I, you know, explain to him and he's not hearing it. And then he goes, I can't be a racist. And I was like, why? And he's like, look at the class I grew up in. And he sends me a class picture and he's the only white guy in this class of black people.
Uh-huh.
And I'm like, well, that... I'm guessing that made you even more racist.
Yeah, that means you're not racist. It means you have really good survival skills. That's all it is.
You spent time with black people in class because you had to.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't mean you're not racist.
Right.
But you can't – the thing about racists that's so frustrating is they get as offended, if not more so, when they're called a racist than when they call people – racist term.
Right, and then they'll find some obscure thing from a racist article to go like, see, this is, because like, but this guy is like, well, USA Today says that USA Today is your source material.
Yeah, that's, yeah.
It's like, you went to high school with me, so you know
me.
And you're going to bring up USA Today as some type of pinnacle of like journalistic hierarchy? It's like, dude, you can't do that.
No.
And then all of a sudden, it was just like, you know, an old queen from New York that was there from Stonewall. It's like, let me tell you something, you cracker bitch. It just went off, and I'm just like, oh, my friend. But I think there is an element of hope. I've got to, because otherwise, I can't do what I do. I can't exist. I mean, when you're teaching, like, kindergartners and first graders and stuff after school, and you're trying to inspire them to do things, you have to do that with hope.
Sure.
In some shape, size, or form. But,
well, I mean, you know, it's our I don't want to call it evolutionary process, but like the evolution of our collective intellect,
mm-hmm.
you know, like evolution itself seems to have a lot of two steps forward, one and a half steps yeah. back. So that's where I find, you know, my silver lining. You know, there's the whole politically correct movement, which a lot of people on, you know, both sides of the political spectrum
yeah.
thought was bad. For me, it did give me hope that there were enough people that wanted to practice just general respect, kindness, mm-hmm. politeness towards somebody else.
Right.
Like, you don't – I don't know why you would want to offend somebody.
Right.
You know, by using political – and I know people go too far.
Right.
You know, the safe spaces, you know, on college campuses
right.
where opposing viewpoint. But then I get like if you have that Milo Constantinopoulos yeah. guy coming to – like the only reason to book that is to start a fucking riot.
Right. You start a riot, get the press. Because the thing about it is, it's like – it's not even that. When he came out, the fact that he was, you know, promoting pedophilia and he's still being allowed to go on Berkeley's campus. And it's just kind of like, well, what are you actually – I mean, Berkeley used to be
– right.
I mean, what Berkeley used to be compared to where it is now. And that's where I generally miss – about when I was both at college and when I was teaching. It was one of those things that I could drop a bomb in my screenwriting classes
yeah.
and just let the students argue about it, take that argument and turn that passion into what they need to do with their characters.
Mm-hmm.
There's no way in hell if I was back teaching screenwriting at USC that I would probably last a semester.
Yeah, because you would be too challenging. Well, you know, and I agree, and I think being challenged, like I'm a 45-year-old man,
mm-hmm.
and I'd still rather have a challenging conversation with somebody
than anybody else. Because,
and that's not—I don't mean like a racist conversation with a racist, because that's not challenging. That's just frustrating,
right? But he's talking about point counterpoint. You bring up a point, they listen to your point, then they can bring something back, and by the time you both leave, you both have learned something about it. It might be I don't like this motherfucker, but you've learned something about him, and you've done it in such a way which makes it. Because I've got friends of mine that. Were, not are, but voted for Trump. I know they voted for Trump.
They won't admit it.
Oh, no, they'll admit it to me.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, they've apologized for doing it, but at the same
time. But is that enough for you?
Well, no.
Because it's not enough for me.
For me, it literally, see, I don't blame the people that voted for him
uh-huh.
because they bought, you know, they drank the Kool-Aid and went there. For me, it's the people on the progressive and left that basically did this argument of, well, I'm going to vote for Jill Stein rather than vote for Hillary because I'm voting with my conscience. And now
yeah.
they're coming up here going like, well, Trump's a monster. It's like, well, you voted with your conscience. Shut the fuck up. Because the thing about it is it boils down to, you know, no matter what happens, and that's the whole thing with this intellectual side of the left, making a decision from an emotional point of view so you can feel that you're right.
Right.
Rather than making the right decision because
right.
it might hurt a little bit, but you can see what was going on. And that's what happened with everything. The Russians, this whole thing is fucked up. But they've learned our culture better than we know our culture.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's why they were able to be successfully, you know, deconstruct us in such a way. I mean, the Black Lives Matter thing was just, it blew my mind.
Yeah.
You know, and just like, but then I've got Russian friends, so it shouldn't have been. I mean, people getting you want to come over and have it. We can drink, you know, you and me.
Yeah.
But I know, like, that mental state, but...
You sound just like Steven Seagal, then.
Oh, Steven, he says,
Did you see that interview?
Yeah, I think...
Where he pronounced... The way he pronounced Vladimir Putin mm-hmm. was hysterical.
Vladimir Putin. I'm like, wow, man. Do you have, like, chocolate in your blood? What the fuck? I literally have gotten to the point where my brain just goes... I can only take a little bit of this. And
right.
then when I'm out and I'm doing stand-up and we've got these young kids that think that they're alt-right comics, which is like...
Ah, oh, Jesus Christ.
Yeah, those have been fun to destroy.
But then
I realize that I'm not doing my work
right.
when I'm up there. But
you're just taking down somebody else.
Yeah, I'm just taking somebody down.
What is an alt-right comic joke?
Well, it's not even like alt-right comics. It's what it is, I would say, young white men... who now feel that they have some type of right to just say whatever the fuck they want to say and not structure it in anything. So, you know, I've had kids up there that just want to use the N-word because they think that it's okay.
They can
use it. And then I hold back. Hey, wait a minute, Youngblood. I want to teach you something. And that's what happened the other day when I said, it's a word I don't use a lot. But now that I've got the perfect person to use it again. So white people, you want to use the word nigga, then just use it for the one person who fits a the best description possible. President. And then I did this whole group of negative stuff that they say they've used the word for and applied it to what Trump's done historically. And then people are like, ha! Fuck.
Right.
And I was just like, if you want to use it, it's just one word in the fucking English language that we ask you not to use and you're trying to find a way to use it. Here's a way to use it. How does that make you feel?
Yeah.
And this guy, we shouldn't say, shut up. It's like, since you've been elected, I walk around with a 6-inch knife in my pocket just in case. It's right here. Please don't make me go grab it.
Yeah.
Because I'm old and I can't.
Because you refuse to get white bones.
I don't want a
white. That's on you. You don't want white bones.
Well, white bones don't mind. And my bone would be okay. Because at least a bone is just there. But a tendon is like, it's kind of like responsible. I want to like gentrify the rest of my body as I'm trying to run. but deep down, I mean, for what we do, it's hard not to do it with hope.
And, sure.
You know, because I don't think anybody goes into the performing arts going like, I want to be rich. And we go in because there's something that impels
us.
Well,
I did.
Well, yes, but you
It was a mistake.
See, you had talent and people liked you.
Yeah.
And I had the mistake of working for agents and managers so I could say whatever the fuck I wanted to casting directors. And that didn't go well for me. Well, I mean, it went well for me when I was with them, but when I left, not so good.
Not so good.
Yeah.
Like what?
Well, I know a couple of casting directors that fucking hated my guts. They're all black.
Why did they hate your guts, do you suppose?
A lot of it had to do with the fact that because I didn't go into that whole, even though I went to Howard University, when I came out here, I wanted to focus on writing. I didn't want to act at all. So when I got into acting, it wasn't like I wasn't doing the normal, let's go to the black casting directors workshops and all this other stuff.
Okay.
My whole thing is that I knew, I book a white sitcom, residuals are going to be good. Thank you, How I Met Your Mother. and so I was focused on basically bringing my style of comedy into areas where I would normally not get cast.
Right.
So when I went to go do most of the sitcoms and they wanted me to do that bit, I refused to do it.
I feel like there's, am I crazy or is there like a movie or a TV series or something? Or a documentary about that actual thing.
Jay Farrow's doing a series on HBO. I forgot what it's called. Like, Some of My Best Friends Are Black or something like that. I just saw it this weekend when I was watching John Oliver. And it's basically dealing with that whole concept of, if you're a person of color, they want you to be a certain thing. I mean, it's changed. So, I mean, because I haven't, I think I stopped acting in 2008. But it's changed since then. I mean, the fact that I booked Girlfriends was like, but it had a white casting director. So, at the time. But the fact that you're watching this stuff, and day-to-day basis, like, the same thing with stand-up. Like, I could go into a black club and do what I do.
Mm-hmm.
Completely fine. I mean, I've been used to going to different clubs. But for me, it's like, it's one of those things that I can listen and be in the back and go boom, 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 boom. And my natural ability of wanting to be me just comes raging out. It's like I go to Orange County, I try not to tell Republican jokes, and the first thing that pops out of my mouth is, so let's talk about this motherfucker Trump. And it's just like, I can't help myself. But for me, it's one of those things about breaking down those barriers for me. Because like, I had this audition for Studio 60 in the Sunset Strip and made the first audition. The second one is in front of producers. And then Aaron Sorkin's there with his best friend.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm like, Sorkin, walk and talk. Yeah, I'm freaking out. So then I go and do the audition. They call me back and say, okay, in a couple of days we want you to come back, but Aaron's not happy with the comedy. Could you rewrite the stand-up bits?
Oh.
You know, to fit more of what you want to do. So, of course, actor side of me left. Writer side of me came in.
Right.
And after I said the first joke, I was like, fuck, that's not what they wanted. But now I've got 45 seconds worth of stuff. Let me sell this shit.
Right.
So I just started busting them, da-da-da-da-da, and everything. It's like, So at the end, Sorkin gives me a hug. He's like, that was excellent, man. And his partner's like, you scared me. He's like, yeah, I hope you did. And then I was like, I walked out the door, got to my car, and just beat the shit out of my horn. Because I knew as soon as I said it, because they wanted an old black comic that does these racist jokes, but he's broken up.
Yeah.
He just doesn't give a shit anymore.
Yeah.
And I turned it into this young black comic that, you know, has all this really witty information about race relations and wants to pop this stuff out, you know, make it a way that makes white people comfortable. And I got a hug from Sorkin, which was not as good as a check, but
that's saying something.
It's saying something. I mean, at the point in time, I mean, it was like, you know, it was one of those things. I met a guy that I respect his writing work, and then he came out a couple of years ago. I think it was last year, and said he didn't know that there was a race problem in Hollywood. And then I was like, well, there went that hero worship.
Yeah, it's amazing how quickly our heroes get tarnished in this.
But he's also used a landscape. Lot of people of color. I mean, like when he did Sports Night and then had Robert Guillaume in Sports Night, which a show that I just loved. And just thinking what he did with The West Wing and other shows that he's done where he's had, you know, a mix of people of color all the time. His movies, not so much. Right. His TV show. So when he said it, I was just kind of like, really? What the fuck?
But I mean, that's the, you know, progressive white progressive liberal criticism that's been happening forever. It's because, I mean, I feel like I was aware of it.
Mm-hmm.
I guess, like, what the fact that the racism has gotten so much louder.
Mm-hmm.
It's enraging to me.
Right.
And I don't sleep anymore. It's not just about race. I mean, it's really about the misogyny is a huge thing. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously homophobia, transphobia, all these, just like the word bigot.
Mm-hmm.
It's that. It's the bigotry that is now everybody's like blah blah. I can say whatever I want,
right.
and I'm sort of like, look, I know this shit existed this whole time, but it was nicer when these assholes were quiet about it.
Right. Well, and it was also one of those things where you have people that have a voice, that use their voice in such a non-specific way, mm-hmm. that their voice ends up becoming white noise.
Right.
And for me, it's just kind of like, yes, there's a certain point in time of the amount of misogyny and racism that actually exists within the entertainment industry. And rather than, you know, pointing at that's wrong, we're not celebrating the people that are doing it right and lifting them up.
Right.
Because it's so much easier to go, you're fucking wrong, than to go like, hey, this comic back here, this show back here is great. I mean, the fact when Jeffrey Tambor basically said, I hope that the next time somebody does a show about a transgender person, they can actually have a transgender person in it.
In it, yeah.
He said it. He moved on. And now, you know, seeing the idea of, like, other shows that are trying to do transgender, but they're not finding transgender actors.
Right.
And doing it. So it's one of those things that
I mean, that's true. You know, our mutual friend Jason Rohr, you know, often makes the argument that, well, it's acting, right? Why are we so sensitive about this person playing that and that person playing that? I kind of see that argument. But, like, when I go into an audition, like, for a period, they don't – you know, the nomenclature changes, you know, like in the late 90s, you know, it's like, hey, can you do that again, make it more urban, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So urban became – just play the black stereotype. Yeah. And then for gay, it was, could you make it more fun?
Mm-hmm.
Means play the gay stereotype.
Yeah.
And I was always like, why? Yeah. I suck at it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not good at accents, right? I don't do accent work because and most of it, if you really look at it, sucks. All the British people and Australian people doing American accents,
yes.
Most of them suck at it.
Right.
And certainly a lot of the American actors doing British accents and Australian accents and other accents, they suck at it.
Right.
Playing some kind of wild stereotype is the same thing.
Right.
That's shitty.
Uh-huh.
You know? So I'm not going to play – if you want me to play a gay character, which I have,
mm-hmm.
but I'm not going to play him as a flamboyant stereotype.
Exactly.
If somebody is that way, which is a thing that exists,
mm-hmm.
of course, have that person do it because it's natural to
exactly.
that. But I'm not going to do it. Don't ask me to make it more fun.
Right.
You know? If you need me to prove my gayness as a character, have me make out with a dude.
Yeah.
On camera.
And that's the thing about it. It's like seeing the people that I know personally on the screen. Which has always been something that's very strange for me because it's always whenever you see a non-trans person playing a trans person on TV.
Sure.
Or in a movie. And understanding that the jump to visibility. But at the same time, when I hear one of my friends talking about that, I said, have you seen Tangerine? What? Have you seen Tangerine?
Right.
So basically, you're talking shit, but you're not supporting the art out there that's actually doing it.
Yeah.
So basically, this makes you feel good because you're so outraged about it, but you're not doing the work to actually promote these people that are out there, like non-binary stand-up comics, you know. Being able to support them, but if somebody makes a joke about it, you bitch about them, but have you seen this person?
Right.
Open up your knowledge, because they're the ones that need our support, because that is going to be a hardship to crack. But lifting these people up to their visibility because you like their work is not.
Yeah.
And it's about a change of focus, which has been interesting just, you know, step by step, because it's been hard to go as I try to slowly get back into writing more. I'm good until they meet me.
So you have a problem in the room?
I'll go into the room like, hey, hey, they try to do the fist bump thing and... This was wow. I was going like, because they talk to me on the phone and everything. Sure. And nobody's like going to visit my website, I guess, you know. I guess because when I'm writing drama, they don't think about Ken Cosby comic.
Right.
So I go into the room. Hello. Yes, I'm here to meet. Who's your Kenneth Cosby? Kenneth Cosby? Yes, yes. You're here to meet. Hold on. We go into the room. Hey, what's up, my man? Yeah, let's come on to sit down, man. Let's just like spit a couple of verses about this like scripture guide. And I'm just looking at him going,
spit a couple verses.
Like, you know, I did study homicide investigation at John Jay College. I know how to hide the bodies. And I'll just sit back there and just like, well, you know about these characters. And I thought this was like really progressive and ideas and da-da-da-da-da and all this other shit. And, you know, my man, like, you know, how, you know, just like, you know, they do an Empire and Power. What the fuck are you trying to say?
Yeah.
So I think the only way that we're going to get to the point where we need to be is I think we'll break it as far as Hollywood racism is concerned if I get cast to play George Washington.
Yeah, there you go.
So I want to be playing, not with...
Or, if I, you know, Idris Elba should be the next James Bond.
He should be, but that...
Well, they fucked it up with the Daniel Craig thing, because they had a perfectly good fan theory that James Bond is just the code name.
Yeah.
And that's why there's different James Bonds.
Mm-hmm.
And then why not make a black James Bond or an Asian James Bond or whatever? Or a lady Bond.
Right. And they can do that.
Jamie Bond.
Yes. But at the same time, you know, and that's where I think, what's the film that Taraji P. Henson's doing? Mary Jane? Is it Mary Jane?
I don't know.
She's playing this assassin. It's fucking awesome. Like, I saw the trailer when I went to go see Wonder Woman. I was like, oh, shit. But, like, when I saw the trailer, like, all the trailers before Wonder Woman was just kind of like, all right, female assassin, female murderer, female... This is kind of cool. But,
yeah, it is kind of cool.
Yeah, for Wonder, it was like, can we just have a woman story? Now they're like Oprah, like, you know, like, you're going to see Atomic Blonde? It's like, eh, wait. It's like, I mean, I could.
Over the summer. I would have gone to see that, but I just haven't had any time to go to movies.
Yeah, I mean,
like that.
I took like a weekend and basically caught up, because I was trying to explain to people, after teaching screenwriting for 18 years, going to movies was difficult.
Yeah, it's like a busman's holiday.
Yeah, well, it's like it's work for me. It's like, you know, I sit back there. It's like when people were like, tell me, oh, The Sixth Sense, you should see it, da-da-da-da-da, as soon as Bruce Willis was revealed. I said, yeah, he's dead. How the fuck do you know that? It's like the way
that he's built. Yeah, I did the same thing, but I made the mistake of leaning over and whispering that in my wife's ear.
Did she punch you?
She was fucking pissed.
Hillary was like,
yeah. And then we went to see The Others, which is basically the same dumb twist. Uh-huh. I leaned towards her, and she's like, ah!
Shut up.
Shut the fuck up.
No, but I think eventually we're going to get... But it's just like with everything that's happening in smaller productions and people that are now, even though they don't have the knowledge to really produce a good-looking piece, they've got the passion to put it out there. And I think that's where things are going to start turning around. Like, you know, dealing with Issa Rae and what she was able to do with Insecure and a lot of the smaller things. And, you know, the fact that my most favorite moment in award history was Moonlight winning.
That
whole thing, like, La La Land.
Yeah.
Movie about jazz with no black people in it.
Yeah, it was like the Super Bowl again.
Yeah, and it was kind of like, sorry. we're going to give this to the black independent film about homosexuality. Like, what? Like, that should be a liberal sheep. Like, oh, we celebrate you black people and your gayness. While this modern day version of Al Jolson's jazz singer...
It was so unfortunate, too, because then all the press afterwards became about how the La La Land people were so gracious and...
Yeah.
But shut the fuck up.
Yeah, I was just kind of like, you know, like, okay, we'll give you, well, thank you. They didn't win. What are they going to do? Fuck you, Negroes!
This is bullshit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Brown versus the Board of Education was shit! I mean, what the hell are they going to say? You know? I mean, they went from, like, you know, not having any black nominees to having a whole bunch. And then, you know, you're dealing with the pandering within the nature of the, you know, the Academy. You just sit back there. So I don't know what next year is going to be.
Actually, you know what pissed me off is the goddamn Emmys. Which I didn't watch.
Yeah, neither did I.
But all of when Spicer rolled out
to do
Spicer's bit, the fact that the whole fucking theater, except for Mel Gibson and Vince Vaughn, didn't stand up and walk out is beyond me.
Yeah.
It's beyond me. Because this is why white liberalism, Hollywood elitism is, you know, constantly being criticized because they just like had this reaction of, and then afterwards you're like, that was bullshit.
Right.
Afterwards doesn't matter.
Right.
It's in the fucking moment. If you're not so fucking offended by the goddamn Emmy people booking this asshole and trying to normalize him and make it a fun bit, you should have fucking, everyone should have fucking walked out. If like, I was there, I would have been like, let's go.
I mean, like that moment was like Jimmy Fallon's Trump moment, but for the whole fucking industry.
Yeah, it really was.
And
nobody's talking about that.
Because I think I was here doing lights for a show when it happened. So it was just when I get home, I'm like, what the fuck?
Right. Yeah. And I mean, and it's not nobody. There are people on social media, but I mean, there's not like, there's no commentary on 24-hour news channels about that. Not even fucking Fox.
Yeah.
Like, that's, here's the hypocrisy of the Hollywood elite
right
here.
Yeah.
We wheeled out Sean Spicer, we made him a big joke, and you didn't do anything about it.
Right.
You just stayed because you wanted to win a trophy.
And that's one of those things. And then, you know, what does the trophy really do? I mean, it's like, understand, like, from the idea of winning it, but I mean, award shows for the most part, I just go, what the, really?
Well, I don't like award shows like, either. The only reason I watch the Academy Awards is I get invited to a house where I drink expensive scotch.
See, and I watch the Tonys just because it's kind of nice to see friends like perform.
Oh, yeah, sure.
But besides that, it's like Oscars, the Emmy, I just kind of go, the Grammys, I just stop watching because I just.
I don't care.
I mean, except for like this year, like when Lady Gaga performed with Metallica. They were having the sound problems. Lars was like, what the And for me, I'm just sitting back here, and I'm just like, I'm not paying attention. He goes, and next up, Lady Gaga performs with Metallica. I was like, wait a minute. I got to see this shit. And then they had sound problems. I'm like, fuck.
I love when they have problems. Well, my favorite Grammy moment is when they were doing one of the musical numbers with Stevie Wonder and Will Smith, you know? And the song ended, and everybody bailed, and the lights went down. And Stevie Wonder was still at the piano because nobody fucking helped him off stage. And he's just in the – you see Stevie Wonder with his hands up like, what the fuck? And then Will Smith himself runs out and is like, holy shit, dude, I'm sorry, and takes him off stage.
I don't know why they just left me here. Sing all alone in the dark. Just where my life is. I don't even try to think anymore. I mean, it's literally – spending so much time both in front and behind the camera gave me a good glimpse of what this industry is about. And the amount of bullshit that's just logged in there is, it's almost to a point, I won't say cancerous, but it's detrimental. And when you call people on their shit, they're really go like, wait, but I've done all this. I'm not talking about the shit you've done. I'm talking about this moment right here.
Right.
Can you just own up that you fucked up now?
Yeah.
And now that I'm not acting, I don't have to worry about it hurting my career. You know, I'm just like calling people, you know, assholes.
I call people that, and it could fuck up my career, but I mean, on my lower tiered level, I mean, I really think it's up to even struggling actors to say no to shit.
Yeah.
You know, like I do. Like, there's parts. And granted, I did an episode of Becker, and I took the part when it was early on. It was written for an Asian guy. And I walked into the audition with these sides. And I'm like, I think this is – I got the wrong sides because it was written in broken English. Like, it was a bad stereotype joke. And that's – I'm – guessing why they were at the last minute. We're like, fuck it, just look at some white guys, and we'll have him do it, and you know, we'll change the lines not to be broken English. But it was very last minute because they hadn't changed any of the lines in the audition. But you know, I, and you know, maybe I should feel bad about that, but I think just in general, just saying no to shit, they like. Saying no to playing a stereotype gay guy if you're not a stereotype gay guy in reality.
It was the same thing where I got to a point in time where I had to make a decision. Am I going to continue playing thugs or am I going to stop? Playing thugs got me into SAG.
Right.
Thugs was getting in front of everything. I decided I wasn't going to do it. I watched the amount of money I was making a year basically bottom out. But on one level, I had a little bit more respect, and at the same point in time, now they were starting to actual hire actual thugs for the roles, so auditions were always weird. It was always where you're sitting next to, like, I booked this gun control PSA. There was this agency called Suspect Talent where they take ex gangbangers and give them acting roles. So I'm sitting there, it's me, and then there's Eddie, who played my name is Earl, he played Crabman. So he's like Eddie Steeples. So he's next to me. So we've got a group of five black guys, and they were like shooting guns across from each other, you know, like with these Latino guys. So they're showing each other their reels at lunch. It is all like America's Most Wanted and everything. I'm reading a newspaper. Some fellow gang members found out that they were there, and they show up on set like there's going to be a fucking shootout. Oh,
Jesus
here.
Christ.
And somehow somebody got word to Danny Trejo, who showed up and calmed that shit down.
Oh, wow. Trejo is fucking everywhere.
Scott Hicks, who directed Chine, was the director of this.
Mm-hmm.
So that's when everybody said, I'm on set reading, you know, the New York Times. As there's a gun battle that's about to happen in the parking lot that they called Danny Trejo to stop, I don't think I'm going to play thugs anymore.
Yeah.
That was it.
Because you don't want to hang out with actual thugs.
Yeah, I mean, I don't mind hanging out with them if we're just like, you know, at a, you know, in a
but if there's
set.
A potential
but if
gunfight.
If we're in East L.A., like, on location, it's like, where anybody can just roll up. I'm like,
no.
Yeah. I mean, the PAs were all fucking nervous because they're all young white kids that went to college. Going like, oh, my God, what's happening? What are these tattoos? I'm like, you got to relax, man. The lowrider was in. Fuck, it had hydraulics and stuff.
Oh, just,
wow. Like, it was popping. I was like, okay, I can get, for this moment, I can get with this, but I would not drive down the street with this fucking thing.
No. I never would either. Feel like I'd get in a lot of trouble if I had a car with
which is gonna really, he's got all these knobs like I you know,
like Warren Beatty and Bulworth.
Oh man, that we want to, that just threw something in the back of my head.
Bulworth,
yeah,
you remember that movie?
Yeah,
I liked that movie.
I liked it too, but there was something about Amir Baraka playing, you know, the with the chorus. And it was just, like, structure-wise, you just see, like, Amir Baraka and, you know, do a poem. And you're like, it's kind of cool. Then I was, like, sitting around with this African-American woman. We were, like, on a date. And she goes, who's that? I'm like, oh, let me tell you something about black history. Just laid down and had this conversation about it. But it was amazing. Like, there's so many people in that film in the background and stuff that, like, have so much prominence in the African-American community that you sit and go, is that it? Oh, shit. And then you get to the end, go, like, I need to watch that again because I was too busy about that person and that person and that person.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's interesting. The thing about that movie that I would imagine could be agitating to a black person is the fact that it is sort of like white fantasy. White savior fantasy.
True.
Although he's kind of a fuck up and crazy, I guess, is the deal.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I'll put it to you this way. If you watch that first, and then you watch BAPS, you can't watch them both. You've got to take, like, a moment, like, okay.
BAPS!
Because, you know, you got Halle Berry in both of them. So you just go, like, okay, so we watch
this, and then we'll move to
watch BAPS. And just, like, you know, see Martin Landau. Just that, oh, my God. I think that's when I basically said, I need to find new people to date at that moment. Like, oh, let's go see this. This will be funny. I'm like, really?
Baps?
We can just, you know, hang back at my place and watch, you know, Doctor Strange. Like, I don't like that movie. It's in black and white.
Well, people don't like black and white movies. That's the thing. That's a weird thing people have. Yeah, I was resistant as a kid to blaxploitation film. Mm-hmm. And as I've gotten older, I've turned into really liking them. Mm-hmm. And just modern black cinema. But I have white friends who say, you know, no, I don't want to watch the Friday movies, or mm-hmm. I don't want to watch, you know, whatever, Fat Beach
yeah.
or something, because I feel guilty.
Why do you feel guilty?
And I'm like, that's what I ask. And they're like, I don't know. I feel like it's not for me. And it's I'm looking at it in more of a pornographic way. And I'm like, what?
That's why you feel guilty. Look at these Negroes doing a film. Like,
oh, so you're fetishizing the black people as opposed to just having fun watching a movie with black people.
It's kind of like, you know, Three the Hard Way.
Sure, yeah.
Excellent freaking film, and especially what's happening in Detroit, Flint, Michigan, and everything. You're watching this, and it's amazing.
Yeah.
And, like, for me, it was one of those things growing up, knowing the people that created them and stuff, and then, like, sitting back and watching all of them. I've got a CD of 159 radio spots for blaxploitation film.
No way.
That I used to play between my sketch shows before I decided that that was driving people nuts. But I remember sitting back there and watching all of these, and I got to a point where I had seen so many, and I had started getting, like, the weird ones, like Blackenstein, and just the ones that were horrible.
Blackula and stuff like that.
With my current girlfriend, we were driving around Hollywood, and I was like, hey, you want me to take you on the Blackula tour? It's like, what? It's like, all the places where they shot Blackula. Because we had just seen Blackula, and I was just like, up here, da-da-da-da-da.
Yeah,
I was
like,
you way too much fucking stuff. So you were at Maverick's flat where they shot all these blaxploitation films. They've given the history, and the person's like giving us a tour and said, yeah, but they also shot this there, this there, this there, this there, this one, this. He's like, how old are you? Oh, I'm 46. He's like, you weren't old enough to, like, what, dude, yeah, what, I know the history, dude.
It's, yeah,
like,
well, that people don't, yeah, people look at me weird when I talk about cinema history, because, like, who cares is the idea. I'm like, but it reflects so much. If you understand the time and when something was made and when it came out and what it's reflecting of where we were at,
yeah,
it's what a great history lesson, just period.
I mean, like, think
and
about
plus blaxploitation films, especially the ones from the 70s, mm-hmm. are fucking fun.
They're fun, and the thing about it is realizing it's the gumption of people that were living on heartstrings.
Yeah.
They have an idea, we're going to put it together. It might not be the best structural thing, but at the same time, like Black Belt Jones.
I love Black Belt Jones. That's the one where they fight for, like, flirt fight on the beach, right?
Yes, yes, and Scatman Crothers plays the lead. And Oscar Williams taught at USC, so he wrote. So there are points in times where you'll be in the middle of a scene and you hear this weird line.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh my God, that's out. Because there's a point in time where the daughter comes back and then the gangsters are all in the pool hall. And it's like, bitch, you need to get out of here. It's like, I'm going to whip you like a sick faggot. She takes off her shoes. And I hear Oscar's West Indian voice saying that all the time. So I'll watch it and just go like, what? We're going to get us some Bogars. Bogars, what are that? Treacherous niggas. And you just like hear these and it's popping into my head. But Jim Kelly, the fight sequence, that fight with Scatman Crothers trying to do karate.
Yeah, it's wonderful.
But then the message behind it is, mm-hmm. is, you know, one of those things that you go and see it for. And then seeing like these act, like, I've got like, probably have close to 50, 60 of them owned, and like, you know, the whole Pam Grier, like, you know, listing.
Yeah, I got most of the Pam Grier movies.
Cleopatra Jones, Coffee. Sweetbacks, Badass Song, Cornbread Earl and Me, Coolie High. I go on and ever. But at the same time, in that moment of cinema, and then it died.
Yeah.
It just died. And then there were a couple of other, like, you had Charles Burnett, who was coming in with To Sleep With Anger and Killer of Sheep, and then Spike Lee, and then John Singleton, and then that started happening, and then that got to a certain point, then it died again.
Yeah.
And right now, I think with this wave of entertainment that's happening, we're starting to see a lot more. Like, Walker Why? I mean, when he did the movies that he was making, and the people that, I forgot the name of the filmmakers that made A Better Tomorrow about the Korean kids in high school.
A Better Tomorrow?
Was it Better Tomorrow?
John Woo movies.
No. This was done with American, and that's right, my head's just like,
I went it could be. Movies have the same title.
But it was one of those things that I know that they had screened.
Yeah.
At Sundance. So this white liberal gets up, like, don't you think, you know, that with all the negative portrayals of Asian Americans, that, you know, you would think for something that was a little more positive about, you know, promoting your culture or something like that. And Roger Ebert got up and cussed that motherfucker out.
Yeah.
These are filmmakers. They can do whatever they want. And this is, and I think that's the argument that people are scared to have when it comes to dealing with different people's culture and their art.
Right.
Do something that validates us so we can think that you're good people.
Right.
Because we want to feel really happy about this film rather than we're human beings, we're fucked up.
Right.
We're going to show you the flaws.
Right.
And deal with it.
Well, and the interesting thing, too, for me about blaxploitation in my personal journey into finding it, you know, and starting to watch it and all that stuff, was I started thinking about all these movies from the 70s that I liked.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you take – I think Clint Eastwood was aping blaxploitation movies with his Dirty Harry movies, certainly. Yeah. And I think there was a lot of that. I mean, and so that's part of me was like, well, when I started seeing – like you see Shaft, I'm like, this is a Dirty Harry movie.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And just in New York instead of San Francisco. So I was like, well, why am I not watching more of these? Because these are the kind of movies I like.
And the thing about that is, like, you think about Shaft, and Shaft in Africa, I'll give a pass. But Shaft.
I actually like Shaft's big score because mostly because the fucking last half of that hour, 45-minute movie is a chase scene.
Yeah.
He's running, he's driving, he's avoiding a helicopter. It's just like a long chase scene. I love that.
And on top of that, I mean, you think about the fact that it was entertaining at the same time, revolutionary for what they were doing, because basically studios were not putting like a lot of money behind them.
No.
I mean, it's like even...
But those movies looked as gritty and good as any given Dirty Harry movie, partially because, certainly with the first two Shaft movies, it's in New York.
Yeah.
And that time in New York...
It's classic.
It's just classic.
But it's even like with Car Wash.
Yeah, Car Wash. I just rewatched that.
Yeah. Now, the thing about it, in the midst of everything that's going on in Car Wash, the story behind it.
Yeah.
Ivan Dixon and Bill Duke, and you're watching this, and you're going to the point, it's like, okay, this is fun, da-da-da-da-da, and you get to thinking, like, what the fuck? What the shit?
Yeah.
Oh, fuck. And that's like, every once in a while, I'll come on TV, and I'll sit back there and just go, like, man. I think the first time I saw it, it was like 10.
Sure, yeah. So it was on TV all the time, like those independent channels. Had. You
know, my parents would go like, send me into something. My dad would always go like, hey, Kenny, we're going to go see this film. Don't take Obama. That's how I saw Raging Bull.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, it was like Raging Bull, which was... Yeah, Better Tomorrow. I was actually trying to find the name of that film. Raging Bull, my dad pulled me out of school. Because my dad was an ex-professional boxer, so he pulled me out of school to see it, not knowing that he was going to turn me into wanting to study film.
Oh, okay.
I saw this, and I was, I'm going to find some way to get to NYU.
Mm-hmm.
And then I found a way to get to NYU, and got cussed out for hanging out in front of the apartment that Scorsese grew up in, Mulberry Street. And
did you really?
Yeah, I was hanging out there just looking up at it. It's like, don't live here anymore, fucker! In my like gear going like it's like okay hero worship
yeah
what the fuck and then I met him a couple of weeks later wow you're tiny like it's like, I love your films but you're tiny it wasn't a Better Tomorrow but I know it had Tomorrow in the title and it's just because when I go to blaxploitation but it was an excellent film that just popped into my head it was like okay as far as that other
right
because sometimes my brain gets clogged like, let me correct that so he doesn't know what the fuck he's talking about
yeah I don't know yeah I get gummed up all the time too but that's probably because I smoke too much weed
I wish I could you I mean I could but
right but it doesn't work for you
well it doesn't really calm me down and I think what ended up happening was when I was going through the first knee surgery a friend of mine had given me one of the lollipops
oh yeah the edibles you gotta be
yeah Oh, no, but this is what happened. So I was going to be, you know, the big man and go like, well, I'm not going to deal with these, you know, opiates because, you know, they're giving me constipation. I've got like a leg in a cast. So I'll just deal with this, you know, just try to weed myself off of it like day three after surgery. So my girlfriend had put like the Vicodin like high up on the shelf.
Uh-huh.
And all of a sudden, I'm laying on the couch, and that surgical pain started to hit. And I'm on crutches, like, trying to find it, realizing it's going to take about 30 to 45 minutes for it to get to my system.
Yeah.
Found the lollipop and was, like, just sucking on it, because I was, like...
Yeah.
About 5 minutes later, I'm like, huh? Pain's gone.
Yeah.
Fuck! I cleaned the kitchen. I wrote, like, about 30 pages in a screenplay.
On a fucked up leg?
On a fucked up leg, but I, like, the Well, the kitchen needed to be clean, but the thing about it is when it took away the pain, because the pain was so intense, it actually allowed me to be functional.
Yeah, yeah.
And I got so much fucking work done. I was like, holy shit. But I ate the whole lollipop. So about the end of the night, I'm like, hey, baby, go watch this movie. What's wrong with you? I want to.
So it's just, but that's just a matter of not taking so much of it.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But, I mean, the thing about it is, like, every once in a while, you know, I'll be with some friends, vape, whatever. But for me, it's one of those things that it doesn't have the effect it used to.
Sure, sure. And well, it's like anything.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like, you know, when I was in college, I was kind of like, oh, we done. But yeah. Now I'm like, you know, I could, if I wanted to have this cyclical conversation, I could do it any other time.
Not having ever done cocaine, I found myself last year at a after hours cocaine party. I still did not do cocaine because I'm old. I'm like, I don't want my heart to blow up.
Uh-huh.
And talk about cyclical conversations. And everybody, except for me and my buddy, were on coke.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, that's what it is. And it's like goldfish mm-hmm. memory length cyclical conversation.
Yeah.
Like for 5 minutes, this guy who I really like, you know, and he was being very nice. It's not, you know, everybody was happy.
Right.
It wasn't like angry cocaine. It wasn't James Woods cocaine. It was just everybody's having fun. But like this guy was telling me how awesome I was. And after about 5 minutes of that, I was like, I appreciate this so much, but is there a way we can change the conversation? Yeah. Let's talk about something other than how awesome I am because I'm starting to feel uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And he's like, oh, yeah, we could totally change the subject. It's just, I mean, I love you and I just wanted you to know. And then the whole 5 minutes started mm-hmm. again. Couldn't get out of it.
Yeah, it's like the same thing with you have people and you're having a deep conversation. And everybody's smoking weed is like, yeah. Biggest dead. You know what about that? I'm like, damn! I was almost out of the woods. Because I'd be like, yo, my girlfriend, man, you know, she's like, you know how it is with women, you know, these females. How they do that thing, you know? I'm like, no.
No.
Well, you see, sometimes, you know, as a man, I got to feel like, you know, woman needs to, so I got this other girl on the side, you know, who does all that stuff, you know, and then got she's always bitching at me at home, so I just go over here. Like, well, okay, so, yeah.
What?
You know about this thing about females? I'm like, shut up!
You know this thing about females?
And I'm just going like, oh my God. It's like, do you understand?
That's the only right answer to that statement. You know this thing about females? No. No, I don't.
What thing?
What thing? Well, I need a girl on the side to do the things that... What are you talking about? Why don't you ask the first one to do those things?
Well, she's my wife, man. You don't want your wife to be doing no nasty shit to your butt. I mean, a crazy girl do that. It's like, just imagine if your wife did do that. You know?
Yeah, just ask your wife to do it. You'll save so much money.
And on the point in time, it's like, now you realize...
You know your wife probably wants you to eat her ass, too.
Yeah, at the same time, you know, but you know, no, man, she's the mother of my kids. You know, I gotta respect her.
Oh, Jesus
Christ. By cheating on her with this woman. Yeah. That's a lot of respect. I just look at him and just going, what the... are you crazy? Yeah. Oh, man. So that's why I just spend a lot of time with these two cats and myself and writing.
Sure.
And I'm out.
Well, I think that's part of the reason I'm such a TV movie addict, mm-hmm. is I can have my quiet conversations with something that's just talking at me, mm-hmm. and I don't have to convince it of anything.
Yeah.
You know, it either convinces me or it doesn't.
Right.
And I don't have to listen to somebody giving me life advice that doesn't make any sense. I mean, you know, I kind of wish I had more black friends who were telling me about, you know, the problems with women. Because I have too many white friends who talk to me about New Age spirituality.
Yeah.
And I think that's worse.
Well, it's always interesting when I'll have conversations with a dude who's basically talking about why he has to have a side chick because he doesn't want his wife to do the stuff that he really wants. Follow that up by women that are now into yoga and tantric sex. And then I'll have a conversation with one person on the phone, followed by another conversation, another in the phone, going like, you two should never meet at all. Because he's going to mess up your, like, you know, enlightenment. And then he's going to be like, yo, you want to do some nasty stuff? Because, you know.
I can't do it with my wife. I respect her too much.
What man in his right mind won't have, like, a two-hour orgasm? That's some bullshit. My wife wants me to kiss and be nice to her. And she sometimes just wants my butthole lit. I'm like, dude, just wash it and then do something that will allow her to like, you know, give you that leniency. Really look at me like, what's wrong with you? I'm like, dude. See, if you talk to the person that you married.
Yeah. It's called communication.
Yes, once you talk to her and then like go like, hey, what are you into? Which you probably didn't have, but you probably stuck it in, didn't put a condom. Oh shit, you got a kid, now I gotta marry this bitch. That's not the thought process.
It's right.
Like, it's a human being, she's got desires, she's got all these things. Treat her as a human being.
Yeah.
Well, but that's my wife. And then you don't blame the white man if you're following the white Jesus with that prospect, man. I don't want to hear that bullshit. And then they look at me like, you heathen. Yeah, I'm a happy heathen too. It's like, I'm spiritual. I don't walk out going like, I'm just going to chop off heads and stuff. But
well, I mean, I think when you talk about religious morality, there's another word, and it's the same thing. It's ethics, being ethical. It's the same damn thing, except you don't need to be afraid of God to do it.
Yeah.
Well, it just makes sense.
But it's also one of those things, like the idea that God is all-knowing, he's all-powerful, but he's going to put his fate in your grubby little hands.
Yeah.
Doesn't make any sense.
It makes no sense. Well, I got to say thank you for having me on your show.
Oh, thanks. And this is great, you know. Just Todd talking to Todd.
Yeah, Todd talking to himself.
And just to correct myself, the name of that film was Better Luck Tomorrow.
Right.
Yeah, Better Luck
Tomorrow. Now I remember that movie. Yeah. I never saw it. I got to look at it.
I was like, holy shit. But this has been fun. I mean, it's good to see you.
You too. I'm glad we got to
freaking time to see each other.
Well, you should come out to my house someday and we'll hang out.
You know what happened in Simi Valley, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so that's why.
Yeah, that's why you don't want to come out.
Well, no. I mean, I don't know if that trial was, you know.
It's not, you know.
I've been up there before.
So. I freely admit that it's a white flight situation, mm-hmm. Because in North Hills, where I was living before, the high school. Mm-hmm. Really bad,
yeah.
And I don't want to send my kid to private school,
right?
Because I don't want to pay for it. And the high schools are better out there, so that's why we moved. But I had heard how very white it was, and it's not nearly as diverse as my neighborhood in North Hills. Right. But it's not as white as
everybody. No, I mean it's changed over the years. But I just remember the first time when I moved out here, and I had a comedy gig up in Simi Valley, and it was on the edge. Uh-huh. You know, right before you get into main people, it's like, oh, brown people, grass, white people.
Yeah.
Like, oh, this grass, show's going to be fun. Grass. It's like, you know, Latinos, grass, white people. Okay. I'm not scared to go up there. It's just one of those things where it's like, because I mean, I taught this class in Agoura Hills like a couple about earlier part of the summer, which was a nice drive. But then I had to get to Pacific Palisades to teach his other class within an hour and a half.
Mm-hmm.
So it was like, oh, GPS is take Malibu Canyon Road.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, my God. Because I already have anxiety from driving from the car accident for the second knee surgery.
Right.
So the fact that it's kind of like
twisty, turny.
And I've got that, you know, raw four. So it's kind of like, what the fuck? I had to pull over three times for panic attacks.
Yeah. And then between there's Box Canyon,
mm-hmm.
which goes basically from where that is, what is it, like Valley Ridge, whatever, uh-huh. that exit is off the 101. And that goes over into Simi.
Yeah.
And that, like, I thought those Malibu and Topanga were fucking precarious. Uh-huh. This one's bananas.
Yeah. And then people are driving me fast as hell.
Oh, yeah.
Like, you know, I'm not going to die. And I have, like, I got instrument trained in high school. So when you're that high up and you look in the ditch and I'm, like, talking to myself, but I'm acting like I'm talking to a control tower, I said, it's time to pull over. Because you're going to go, and then, what happened to Mr. Kid? He killed himself. No, but this was a great time.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for having me on your program.
Well, you're welcome.